Good morning. May it please the Court, Becky Walker-James appearing on behalf of the defendant, Billy Joe Palomo. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Just watch the clock, counsel.
I will. Mr. Palomo is serving a 10-year sentence, even though he did not he pled guilty not understanding that he was facing a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence, and the evidence, in fact, did not support the 10-year sentence. And this situation came about due to several errors in the district court. First, there were two serious Rule 11 violations. First, the court did not ensure that the defendant understood the mandatory minimum 10-year sentence. And second, did not ensure there was a sufficient factual basis to support even the basic elements of the offense, and certainly not the facts to support the 10-year quantity.
Ms. Walker, do we not have a factual finding from Judge Tiding O'Gates that he did, in fact, understand based on the hearing that she held and her review of the plea colloquy before the magistrate judge?
Well, Your Honor, what the judge really focused on in the motion to substitute counsel was the lawyer's representation that the dispute was really over the third-party custodian issue, and she did discuss with him, with the defendant, that he had told the magistrate judge that he understood. However, what Mr. Palomo, in fact, said was, honestly, Your Honor, I didn't understand. My lawyer was just telling me, just sign this, just say yes. So that's what the record reflects, is that he was being pressured to,
You answered my question. My question was, do we or do we not have a factual finding from the district court judge as a result of the hearing that he did, in fact, understand that there was a 10-year mandatory minimum?
Well, Your Honor, I don't read the record as making that finding, because I think the court was really focused on the wrong question, and she wasn't really exploring with the defendant whether he in fact understood. That's one of the problems with the colloquy in the motion to substitute counsel, was that it really was inadequate to explore whether counsel and the client had really explained that issue and whether he in fact understood it.
Putting aside for a moment Judge Tallman's question, with which I strongly concur and hope you will answer, about what the judge's finding were, it seems like you're contending that somehow the judge had a responsibility to, instead of letting him read it for himself, to basically walk it through like it was a law class. Is that your contention?
Is Your Honor referring to the factual basis?
Correct.
For the plea? I think it was inadequate in this
okay,
situation.
Okay, but I'm saying, do you have any, Gaither seems to suggest exactly to the contrary. Do you have any authority on which you can rely that suggests that what the district judge did here was inadequate as a matter of law?
Well, I think we have cited cases, I believe it's Kennell and Pena, which suggest that just reading a factual basis in a plea agreement is insufficient.
But well, that's not what you had here, was it?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. That's all the judge asked him to do, was to read the plea agreement silently to himself.
And how do you distinguish Gaither?
Your Honor, I may have to review Gaither. Maybe I can hit that in rebuttal, but very quickly. But the bottom line here is that there was a factual basis in the plea agreement, a very bare bones factual basis in the plea agreement, which he was just asked to read silently. He wasn't asked about his reading capabilities. He wasn't asked any questions to explore his state of mind about whether he really understood those facts.
What do we do? I'm looking at, I think it's excerpt of record page 77, and Mr. Smith is engaged in a colloquy with, I believe it's Judge Gates, in which he says, I think it's clear that he's had an opportunity to see the pre-sentence report. He knows the plea agreement he signed. He knows the time he's going to serve, and I think he's getting the jitters. And then the court makes a factual finding that basically this amounted to buyer's remorse. Why shouldn't I read that record to conclude that he did, in fact, understand that he was looking at a 10-year mandatory minimum, but maybe it didn't settle in completely until he saw the pre-sentence report that reinforced it?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I'm seeing that on page 77. But
no, it's I have 77 and 78, but okay. It's pages 27 and 28 of the typewritten transcript of the hearing held before Judge Gates on May 28, 2009. starting at line 25 on page 27 of the typewritten transcript.
Well, right, and that's counsel's representation to the court that it's clear he's had an opportunity to see the pre-sentence report.
And he did say the reason, I mean, you're a former assistant U.S. attorney. You understand why we ask clients to sign pre-sentence reports. It's an indication that the client has, in fact, reviewed the report with his lawyer and understands and abides by the contract that he's about to enter. Isn't that the whole purpose for having the defendant sign it?
Sure, Your Honor, although 2 points. First, this was a discussion about the pre-sentence, about the pre-sentence report and having seen it and having gotten buyer's remorse.
I'm looking at the top of page 28, line 1. He knows the plea agreement he signed. Why can't the district court rely on the representation of the defendant's counsel?
Well, in this context, because the defendant has himself come forward to the court and said, I have a dispute with my counsel. I'm not being adequately represented here. There's a breakdown in our communication. I really didn't understand. I thought
Let's go to what your client himself understood. Looking at the plea colloquy, bait stamp 36, at line 39, I'm sorry, starting at line 15, the court says, now the maximum sentence for conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute over 50 grams of methamphetamine is life imprisonment, a $4 million fine, a minimum mandatory term of 10 years of incarceration, which may not be stayed or suspended by the court. You go over then to the next page, bait stamp 37, and the court says, and do you understand then the consequences of your plea in relation to the penalty by pleading guilty here this morning, the defendant? Yes, Your Honor. No attorney involved there, just your client. Why isn't that kind of a bookend to what Judge Tallman was talking about in terms of what the attorney said?
Right, because he was only asked if he understood the maximum penalty.
What else were we talking about here?
The mandatory minimum penalty.
That's what we're talking about here.
Well, no. In fact, if you read it, he's only asked on page 8, ER 37, do you understand this to be the maximum penalty that you face by pleading guilty?
But on 36, I just read on line 18, a minimum mandatory term of 10 years of incorporation. That's not a maximum. That's a minimum.
That is true.
Why should we not take your client's word for understanding it?
Well, because he wasn't asked whether he understood that portion. He was only asked if he understood the maximum.
He was. Right after that, the court asked him whether he understood. He said he did.
But he understood the maximum penalty. And the problem here is that it's very confusing because in both the plea agreement and the plea colloquy, the mandatory minimum is buried in this discussion of the maximum penalty. So it's confusing.
He was directed by the magistrate judge to paragraph 5, which contains the line on the statement on line 26, and a mandatory minimum term of 10 years of incarceration, which may not be stayed or suspended by the court. And the evidence before us is that the defendant was looking at that paragraph as the judge was engaging him in a dialogue as to whether he understood it.
Right. But again, it's the same error in the plea agreement that was in the colloquy here, which is that it states the maximum penalties are the following, and buried within that is this reference to a mandatory minimum 10 years.
So you're down to about a minute and a half. If you wish to reserve, you may do so.
I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honors. Law students, counselors, appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm with the United States Attorney's Office on Guam, and I'm an assistant United States Attorney, and my name is Fred Black. I was fascinated by why the Supreme Court took the time that they did to reverse the Ninth Circuit twice, both in the Vaughn case and the Benitez case, a case that Judge Tallman must know very well, since he basically wrote the opinion of the Supreme Court in his dissent.
That's
before the Ninth Circuit.
But I don't think we want to go quite that far, at least on the record.
90% of our criminal cases today get resolved via plea agreements. And the Supreme Court has said there's something solemn about that. When somebody raises their hand and swears under oath, and they've signed an 8-page plea agreement, and they spent a month and a half working with their lawyer, and their lawyer and themselves say that they understand all the terms of the plea agreement, and the client says that he's satisfied with the lawyer, then to just a week or so before the planned sentencing to come in before the court and say, Your Honor, I'm upset because there's a 10-year mandatory minimum that I didn't fully understand, which wasn't even contained in the letter that he had sent to the judge, that obviously some jailhouse lawyer prepared for him, and he acknowledged that before the court. The question is, why would we ignore the written document, the plea agreement, that says about the mandatory minimum, and not a single case that the defense primarily relies on the Adams and the Benz case? I mean, this whole case, although there's 30 cases cited, could be resolved just with looking at four cases. The Adams and Benz case deal with the situation of where there was no written plea agreement that said what the mandatory minimum was, and the judge failed to advise them. Well, obviously, that would be defective, even under the Vaughn case and even under the Benitez case. Basically, the Adams and Benz case stands for the proposition that somewhere in the record there has to be an advice of mandatory minimum. The defense has cited to not a single case where the judge has advised the defendant of the mandatory minimum that was done in this case, where any court has ever reversed anywhere, any circuit in the country. The only two cases she could find were two cases where the court hadn't advised at all. The Kennel case that she talked about basically has been reversed, and that was discussed in the Benitez case. Then she argues that, well, there wasn't a showing of 50 grams. Of course, that wasn't part of her oral argument here, but it's part of her argument. There, the defendant acknowledged that he had conspired to distribute 50 grams. This isn't like a substantive case where you have a laboratory analysis of the exact amount. He didn't have to bring any methamphetamine at all into Guam. It was sufficient that he brought in what he did bring in, and that there were seven other deliveries. And the conspiracy didn't end on that occasion. It went for several months beyond that. And we've got to take the defendant at his word. Under oath, he admitted that he was involved in a conspiracy in which over 50 grams.
And that satisfies the Apprendi argument they raise, right?
Absolutely. And the two cases cited by the defense to the opposite are totally off base, because in those indictments, Velasco and Valenzas, something like that, those two cases starting with a V, the indictment didn't specify any quantity at all, whereas our indictment specifically charged him with over 50 grams, and he acknowledged that he was involved with over 50 grams. So we have to take him at his word. There was some friction, apparently, with the defense attorney. The judge conducted an elaborate hearing to determine whether or not this was a miscarriage of justice, some kind of irreconcilable conflict, and the court found to the contrary. And during that time, several times the issue of the 10-year mandatory minimum, easily this court can find when looking at the whole record, that he knew that he was facing a 10-year mandatory minimum. He never withdrew his plea. So under the
plea. Can we go back for just a minute to the question that Judge Tallman raised? He asked opposing counsel, what deference, in effect, do we owe the finding of the lower court with respect to how much the defendant here understood? What is your understanding of the standard of review that we apply to that?
I think it's an abuse of discretion standard, whether or not the court abused their discretion when they found...
In terms of a factual finding, or...
Why shouldn't it be clear error?
I'm not sure I fully understand the court's question, but clear error sounds correct to me.
basically, the point here is that the defendant has a burden. The defendant's going to change things.
Right.
So what I'm asking you is, what is the burden under the case law? What does the defense have to show under the case law to overcome the finding of the lower court?
Well, first of all, they have to show that there was plain error, error that was clearly error. Now, they haven't been able to do that because the two cases they've cited to aren't at all on point. The fact is that this defendant did understand that there was a 10-year mandatory minimum. The court had asked him if he had read the plea agreement, whether he understood all the terms, whether he was satisfied with his lawyer.
I appreciate that, but I'd like you to give me an answer to this specific question. In this particular case, there was a finding made. What are we to do with this? We're a court of appeal. We're not a trial court. Do we have do we have to wait for the defendant to overcome a clear error standard? If it's was there an objection made? If there was, or are we talking? We can't be talking plain error then, can we? So in other words, so tell me what the standard of review is for our purposes on that factual issue.
Not only does the not only do you have to find that there was clear, plain error, but you also have to find that the error was substantial. Plain error is what's substantial.
Well, plain error is when somebody doesn't object. Was there an objection made in this case to this particular point?
Not during the plea colloquy.
Okay, so we are reviewing for plain error, and under that standard, what does the defendant have to do to overcome the finding of the lower court?
He has to be able to show that the error seriously affects the fairness, the integrity, or the public reputation of the judicial proceedings. And clearly, based on the written document, the lawyer's assurances that he had gone over every single term with this plea agreement, that there wasn't an issue of the 10. In fact, the reason it took a month and a half to get the plea together is because the defendant was going back and forth arguing quantities of narcotics with his lawyer. That was part of the transcripts.
I think we may be confusing apples and oranges here. I think what we're struggling with is he came before Judge Gates on a motion to replace his counsel. The court held a hearing and made a finding of fact that he understood the consequences of the plea and that there really was no breakdown in communications, that to the extent that there was a disagreement, as I read the record, it was over his lawyer's refusal to try and get him released to a third-party custodian, his ill mother. And that's the factual finding that we have. And don't we review that for clear error? And if that's true, then it's an abuse of discretion standard that we apply in determining whether or not the district court abused its discretion in denying the motion to replace his counsel. Isn't that the correct analysis?
Absolutely. And the three factors that you look at to determine that is whether there was adequacy of the court's inquiry down below. You look at the extent of the conflict and whether the court had explored that issue, and the timeliness of the defendant's motions. Those are the three factors set forth in the Gonzalez case. The cases that the defense cited, I mean, basically the defendant and the lawyer were at war with each other. That wasn't at all the case here, and the court gave them time to talk about it. They came back into court months later and said that things were fine. I mean, the defendant didn't speak up, but this defendant was not at all bashful. He was very smart, and the court acknowledged that and almost made a finding of that when he read the jailhouse lawyer's written statement that first the defendant claimed was his own, then he claimed it wasn't. The judge says, well, your office is obviously very bright, and then he tried to say, well, it's not, I didn't write it, somebody else wrote it, and the judge says, so these aren't yours? Oh, yes, Your Honor, they're my words. I mean, it goes back and forth flip-flopping as he tries to figure out a way from underneath his sentence. The fact is that he was faced with a pretty good deal, and all he needed to do was cooperate. He chose not to cooperate. He was conflicted on that from the very beginning. In the end, he decided to go with his drug dealer father and not turn the father in. And so he's paying the 10-year price for being a major narcotics dealer on Guam. Brought in 7 loads of methamphetamine that we knew about at that time.
Anything further, counsel?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
James, you have some reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to respond to a couple of the court's questions first. First of all, as to the court's finding of, that he understood the 10-year quantity, you know, with all due respect, I don't see the court as making that finding. In looking at the transcript from the hearing, what she did find is that he had dismay about his 10-year mandatory sentence, but that certainly doesn't mean he didn't understand it. In fact, it could mean quite the opposite, that when he discovered it, he was quite dismayed.
Which record are you referring to? You're talking about the sentencing?
This is the substitution of counsel. Right, and that would be at page ER 71. Where she makes that observation. And then later on, at page 73 of the excerpt of record, she does note that he appeared before the magistrate, and he's already found that your guilty plea has been made freely, knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and that you have waived your right to a jury. So it's time just to proceed forward with your counsel. But that's not a finding of her own, that it, in fact, was voluntary.
Did she have a transcript of the magistrate judge proceeding that she reviewed prior to the hearing that she conducted? Do you know?
I'm not sure, but I don't think it's reflected in the record that she did, so she probably did not. But, of course, the plea would not have been accepted but for that. And there is a document.
She was assuming certain things from the magistrate judge's prior proceeding.
Right. I think that's correct. Yeah. And then I just want to address briefly the Gaither case. In that case, the prosecutor did make an oral offer of proof, so it was on the record what the facts were that the defendant was saying he did do. But here we have just a silent reading of the plea agreement. And as we discussed,
and an inquiry as to whether he understood.
And an inquiry as to whether he understood, but understood only what he had silently read in the plea agreement.
What was read to him by the court.
Well, here it wasn't read to him out loud. I mean, he was asked to read it silently to himself, in this case.
And from what I read, a discussion of a minimum mandatory sentence. This court specifically referred to that, and he said he understood. So right. What do we make of that?
Well, again, I have to come back to, there was a reference to it, but this is actually quite similar to the Benz case, in which there was actually a reference in the Benz case to the statutory minimum of 10 days in that case, a 10-day sentence. But the court held that it was inadequate because it was unclear, and he was never asked whether he understood that particular provision. And, as you know, just saying that throwing out a mandatory minimum, especially here in the context of putting it within the maximum sentence, there's a big difference between maximum sentences and minimum sentences.
Well,
and that
you,
was
counsel.
Never
oh,
played
sure.
out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm repeating this unnecessarily, but in looking at the transcript on page 36 of the magistrate judge's colloquy, the magistrate judge did recite the language, a minimum mandatory term of 10 years incarceration, starting at line 17, which may not be stayed or suspended by the court. And then he asked, and then he went on to talk about the rest of the punishment. And then he said, do you understand this to be the maximum penalty that you face by pleading guilty here this morning? And your client says, yes, Your Honor.
Right. But again, he's asked, do you understand this to be the maximum penalty? And,
no,
and when you...
Do you understand the consequences of the plea in relation to the penalty by pleading guilty? And that's part of what he just read to the defendant. I just don't understand why we're torturing the language quite so much when it's all there.
Well, I don't think it's torturing it, Your Honor. Really, all it had to be asked was, do you understand that there's a 10-year mandatory minimum here, which is what Rule 11 requires.
But I just read it to him, and then he asked, do you understand the consequences? That's why I mean, you're really splitting hairs here. It seems.
This is Abu Ghraib in a legal sense.
Well, Your Honor, it could have been so simply clarified, and the rule is clear for that reason. And, in fact, the rule was amended. It did previously state needs to ask whether the defendant understands the consequences of the plea, and that was amended specifically to say they have to understand the mandatory minimum.
So your point, I think, is that he should have broken up the compound questions that are contained in paragraph 5 of the plea agreement and just gone through it sort of piece by piece. You understand that, you understand that, you understand that.
Well, not necessarily every piece, because a lot of them were maximum penalties. The fines, the supervised release, all those things are maximum penalties. But this one piece was particularly important.
Sure.
This 10-year mandatory minimum was awfully important. And there's every reason to believe that he would not have entered a guilty plea, especially since it wasn't going to do him any good if he wasn't going to cooperate.
Right. Thank you, counsel. Our questions have taken you way over your time.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor.
The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and we will hear argument next in the case of Conahan versus Sebelius.